Okay, so I do want to say that this represents work closely associated with this conference. It only got started when I heard my office mate talking about running scalar waves, and I said, can you run it in a different background metric? And he said, yeah. I was interested in the hyperboloidal slicings. The big question is, could it possibly be easy? Might it happen that if you simply put in a hyperboloidal slicing and ran your Cauchy programs, that it didn't take much twiddling to make them run because the slices are space-like? So that was the question. Of course, as always, you know things can't be perfect. This little poem was given to me by my wife when she saw how hard we were working here. Pete Hein, the reason she thought of him on that occasion, we'd gotten from some friends a biographical article about Bengt Stromgren, who was a good friend of ours, a Danish astronomer. And in this article was a photograph taken at the Bohr Institute showing Niels Bohr, Pete Hein, and Heisenberg standing next to each other along with a lot of other people in the seminar room at the Bohr Institute. But he did a lot of these poems that he's called Grux, that was his name for these poems. Okay, so now we go on. This is the first attempt and half of what we're going to show you today. You just take the standard hyperboloid in Minkowski space and say, well, that's a space-like surface. You can undoubtedly find things like that in a lot of metrics we're interested in, and Helmut has reorganized the Einstein equations to take advantage of that, and we've heard about it from Sasha. And we also think of this as Cauchy characteristic matching, except instead of doing it by an explicit matching, you just set your parameter so there's a flat space in the middle that you hope will run like Cauchy and a distant region that you hope will run like characteristics. So that's the game. And here's what we would like to be able to see in our first run, is just send in a wave, a spherical wave, although it's all being done in 3D by the program that Mark and Lee have been working hard on. The scalar part of it works very well. They're still, I think, working hard to get GR evolution going. But everything I'm talking about today, and we're talking about today, is just scalar waves on a fixed background, either Minkowski or Schwarzschild. So the wave comes in, you specify initial conditions on one U equals, we call this time coordinate U equals 0 surface or -5. And then at some point, interactions are going on. The only interaction we have is the superposition of the waves coming in different directions. And the waves go on out, and by a finite time later, everything is gone. So that's the hope that it might be run that easy. So the big question, would Cauchy codes work without too much twiddling? Do you have to completely reorganize everything to use hyperboloids? Big worry is the current condition when you're running out there with big shifts. Would it make the boundaries easier? There are some indications that it might. We're not finished with that yet. And can you do wave extraction? I would expect if things work, that would be possible. Things that we're not looked at so far, but we know would have to be done to do this in GR, is to get initial value sets that you wanted to work with on hyperboloidal slices, although Lee and Mark think that might not be absolutely necessary. You might start with a flat slice and design your evolution so that the evolution codes searched for the hyperboloidal slices at later times. If you want under any circumstances to run in GR, you would need to have slicing conditions, presumably lapse conditions, that either search for or maintain these hyperboloidal slices as you evolve. And we discover in this work, while working on the current conditions, that you've got to get your spatial coordinates distributed properly or you have problems, and we'll see more of that. And then there are other problems that everybody has that we have no special insight into, like boundary conditions on moving black holes and all kinds of other things that are part of the Cauchy evolution, not associated with the outer boundary, that don't expect to be either improved or severely deteriorated by working with this stuff. So we go back and try to do that example. I write a formula for it, which has got this A, that's just the equation of a hyperboloid. U is our new time coordinate, U equals constant is a space-like hypersurface, and the significance of that A is that it measures, it tells you how far the hyperboloid is away from the light cone that it's asymptotic to. Notice in particular here that if you have something going on down here that propagates at not faster than the speed of light, why, if it's going, particularly if it's going at the speed of light, by time A later, anything that was sent out from here at the speed of light, by time A later, it has gone all the way to scry. So you get to scry in a finite time if you're going at the speed of light in this. Things that happen here are already at scry on that surface that you integrate to. So that's the big game. How do we do it explicitly in Schwarzschild? You put in the equation of a hyperbola, U equals constant a hyperbola. This A parameter you can call the scry delay. It's how long it takes things that happen at one time to get out to scry. You just plug that into the standard Minkowski metric and you come up with this, and so you have a lapse that's going to infinity, you have a shift that's going to infinity, and you will have to deal with these things. So we look here and want to see the coordinate velocity of light, which will be the critical thing for Courant conditions. So you just set ds squared equal to zero radially in and out to find the coordinate speed of light, and you get formulas like this, and if the speed of light goes like r squared, going outward. Going inward, the speed of light stays actually finite. These two things cancel, and you get something different. So I'll show you graphs of those in a minute. But the Courant condition tells you that if you stuck with these speeds of light going like r squared at infinity down here, why, your time steps would have to be very, very small. That is, they would have to be very, very small if the space steps were very, very small or constant. Here's an exact solution of the outgoing waves in Minkowski space, the one we'll deal with. You take any shape, we use Gaussians, but you can have any pulse shape you like. Here's these two cancel to make it regular at the origin, and at late times, assuming this is a pulse that turns off, this is the only thing that remains. The argument of the function up here is now your time coordinate u plus 1 over r corrections. So roughly, the wave behavior as you go out on the hyperboloid, the wave behavior of this quantity is just a constant over r. No matter how sharp your wavelengths are, you can only pick them up in this term. You can only see any variations out there, which means that you can use very big space intervals. And if your space intervals are big enough, why, your time intervals can be okay according to Courant. So that would be the procedure. We
another way to say it, sorry, is that as far as coordinates and current conditions and so on go, you do exactly the same kind of coordinates if you compactify. Since you compactify with the overall conformal factor,
right,
it leaves the causal structure alone. So it's just
right. Right. So that's what we do. So the next step is, I call it analytic mesh refinement. You compactify by changing r equals infinity to r equals 2. So we now have coordinates in which scry is at r equals 2. So it's the compactification. And we run it that way. I'll show you the analytic solution in these compactified coordinates. Since the waves are computed without actually computing the wave function phi, del squared phi equals 0, they don't compute the wave function phi because they don't need it to compute time derivatives and gradients. So this is the gradient of a Gaussian, or the time derivative of a Gaussian, and I want to run it. I couldn't figure out how to make animated things run in PowerPoint, so I have to go to a different presentation. But here it is, a very simple graph that I can program into computer using Maple. So that's that wave that I showed you. And notice the wavelengths get longer and longer, even in this coordinate, as the wave goes out to infinity. So it's going to, it's still ticking along, but the wave is out to scry and you can't see it. And it'll start again in a second. I think it will. There it comes. So that's the incoming wave. Hits the origin and is non-singular there due to the second term in that formula. Starts going out. Notice the wavelengths are almost, half wavelengths are almost 0.3 or 0.4 here, whereas they started out at about 0.1 or 0.2. So the wavelengths get, even here, get very, very long as you approach sky. So you don't, hopefully you don't need a lot of resolution out there, but we haven't solved that problem yet because we haven't done everything that needs to be done. Yeah, here's a half wavelength of order 10th that becomes.
So there's a nice little paper by Eric Flandin where he compares waves on flat space in the Gaussian characteristic and half the order coordinates, and he compares what the waves look like in the different coordinates. You see this kind of things compared.
Great. Well, I have to get that reference for you so we can use it. Okay, so now we go back to the, where are we? There we are. So after you've done that coordinate transformation in space, you get this metric. Here's your conformal factor, just a constant over this quantity Q that'll keep showing up, so I gave it a name. This is the one that goes from, you know, 0 to 2. It goes from 1 at the origin to 0 at scry. And so that'll keep showing up. And the lapse has this other factor in it, which goes from 1 to 2 as you run out, but the denominator blows up. And your actual shift is blowing up like everything else. And the phase two of this sort of program, I think, would be to take that factor out of everything analytically before you put it on the computer. And the analog of that in GR would have to be to look at some of the things like Sasha was showing us, except instead of having a scale factor that's one of your dynamical variables, you would simply put in a scale factor that makes life simple for scalar waves in Kerr and say, we're only trying to solve with these hyperboloids the problems at infinity. If you put in that fixed scale factor, it's sort of like fixed mesh refinement. That should put infinity under control, and then you can concentrate your worries on the Cauchy sections in the middle.
So the problem is that, so if one could choose a fixed conformal factor,
right?
Okay, if you would know how to do it, you would immediately learn.
Right.
It's just, it's not yet known how to do it. How to have useful equations with a fixed conformal factor.
Okay.
The characteristic of Gauss, it's known how to do it.
Uh-huh.
And that's one of the powers of the characteristic of conformal magnification, that you can specify
I see. Okay.
Okay.
Well, I'll be trying to play with that and learn what the problems are. What my approach would be simply to study Kerr a little more. I've done a little bit on that, but it's not entirely easy. I don't think you need to have constant mean curvature slicings to get this. You need to know how to aim your shift to maintain the condition that you've got. But if I could find some good slicings of Kerr, why, I think those factors might work more generally, but I haven't found them yet. Okay, so this is what Mark will be showing you solutions in this, of the scalar wave equation in that background. For the Courant factor worries, your outgoing coordinate speed of light varies from 1 to 4. Your ingoing speed varies from 1 at the center, from minus 1 near the center, to zero out at scry. And that was another one of our hopes. Remains to be seen how well it'll work ever. And that is that with the incoming waves having very low velocities at scry, maybe you could be a little cavalier on your boundary conditions, because even if something got reflected or something came in through Scry improperly, it wouldn't get in very far for a long time. So I don't think we've got that.
That'll be the physical signal, but the numerical signal that propagates point to point, or in their case, it's spectral propagation.
Yeah, it does all kinds of weird things. That's right, yeah. So it's only physical modes that necessarily obey this, although some people are writing codes where they hope everything has controlled speeds. Okay. So then, I don't know, do you want to step in here and show those, or do you want me to?
No, go ahead.
Okay, I'll go ahead with, so the next step, but you'll see a bunch of computations done with that Minkowski background. So then we go on, and to do it with Schwarzschild, we just looked up a good metric for Schwarzschild having hyperboloidal slicings, which was found in recent papers by Malak and Omer, who, of course, there's been a lot of early work they cite on these things. And turned out that we didn't want to understand every possible slicing, we just wanted one useful one. The simplest one doesn't work, and that's why you'll see the formula is a little bit more complicated, because the simplest one insists that the slices all go through the white hole side of the Kruskal diagram, and they don't reach the black hole. So, okay, and we haven't really put the initial conditions for the Schwarzschild runs into forms where we understand physically where the pulse is and what it's doing when we set it in. So their Schwarzschild metric looks like this in a Schwarzschild R coordinate. Your lapse here has got the A, the characteristic of the Scry delay parameter, and then it had another parameter, which I called kappa, that was needed to make the slices go through the black hole. And so this two-parameter family we pulled out of Malak and Omerho. Okay, but as in the other case, we don't want the speeds of light going to infinity. You can look at what they are. They're just given in terms of those previous parameters by simple formulas. However, when you look at those formulas at R equals 2m, at R equals 2m, you see this term goes away, and therefore B squared is essentially the same as beta. And that means that when you look at the light speeds, that the outgoing, at R equals 2m, the outgoing, these two things will cancel only if beta is positive. And to get beta positive, you need a kappa. Whoop, where is it? To get beta to be positive at R equals 2m, you need to have a kappa in there. And so you had to have that variable in there to get the thing working. Okay, so the extrinsic curvature, the kappa parameterizes how much transverse traceless external curvature there is, extrinsic curvature there is. The intrinsic curvature is just minus 3 over A in the conventions most people use in their codes, which makes the trace K negative for these slices. The other thing to note about this is that Schwarzschild's M does not appear in this. So even in flat space, these slices with kappa go to become singular at the origin. They don't necessarily all become singular in Schwarzschild because some of them, which we don't use, can be arranged in the Kruskal diagram to stay inside and go out to Scry plus on both sides. Okay, then the M does occur in the curvature of the three space, but you take the trace, and of course, consistent with the constraint equations, it's got to be independent of M because the K is where. Okay, then we do the same thing we did before, exactly the same coordinate transformation, because we didn't see any need to be more ingenious, but I just want you to remember this Q since it appears in other formulas. We get a metric that looks a bit different. This F function is no longer 1. But otherwise, beta has these properties that we will need to get the sign under control for the kappa there and so forth. But anyway, the formulas are more or less pretty much manageable. And you still have this overall conformal factor that you could have set beforehand in these examples if you wanted to rewrite the scalar wave equation. But so far, we haven't rewritten the scalar wave equation. The other feature was that if you look at that metric, M and kappa only appear in these combinations, which vanish rather rapidly as Q goes to 0 at R equals 2. So look back at here's an M times Q cubed, kappa times Q cubed, so forth. So likewise, that's still cubed there. So it looks as though it's going to be that way. The light speeds, and these are the parameters we actually typically used. We set this, the A, the curvature, or the scry delay equal to 4m, so that you'd have a reasonable Cauchy region bigger than m in the center. There's a lower limit on kappa to make the slices go through the black hole. And this is a little bit bigger. If you get too close to the limit, you get coordinate singularities in using the Schwarzschild R where you don't want them. And so we made it big enough. But now the slices actually go all the way into R equals 0 in the Kruskal diagram. They're singular at that point. But we don't expect to go there. And one thing that will occur later, this is the same plot just shown in a smaller region. There's this funny behavior of the ingoing speeds that they fall in rapidly, and then just before they cross the horizon is of course where the outgoing speed is 0, just before they cross the horizon, they've got to climb this hill, and that tends to make the waves break, is the interpretation we figured out when we saw it going on. The leading edge of a wave starts to slow down, and the following edge catches up with it, and you get to need a bit of resolution to be able to handle that feature of what's going on. So that, I think, is everything I've got. I'll turn it on to Mark to describe what the computations have shown.
Okay.
Do you want me to try to bring up your first slide?
Sure, bring up the that one.
Okay.
Bring up this.
Ah, yeah, that's a good idea, too. Just put this on anywhere. And put that down here. Okay, so Charlie told you all about the background that we're going to evolve, but I want to tell you first about what we're actually going to put on that background. So we're going to put the simplest possible thing, a scalar wave.
For the tape or whatever it is, but this is closely related to a talk we heard earlier about your spectral codes and so forth.
Oh, yes, okay. Well, you mentioned that already, but yeah, so I'm also going to mention that the code that we're using to evolve this is the spectral code developed by Larry Kidder and Saul Tucholsky and Harold Pfeiffer and myself, and Lee has recently joined this effort and is pounding away at the GR part of the code at the moment. So this code assumes that all of your it assumes that the system that you're evolving is in first order symmetric hyperbolic form. So in order to evolve the wave equation, we want to define some first order variables. Recall that this U variable, even though a lot of times people use U to denote a null coordinate, it really is a time-like coordinate. It's just called U because it approaches null at scry. So here are the first order variables that we use. Let's put the easiest one down here. This phi I is just a spatial derivative, and these I's are just spatial, so they're going to be in a pseudo-Cartesian coordinate system where x squared plus y squared plus z squared is the little r squared that Charlie mentioned before. And this pi is morally the time derivative of the scalar field, but it turns out to be much more convenient to make it the normal derivative of the scalar field. So there's a shift in there and a lapse in there. And when you write out the scalar field equation in 3 plus 1 form using these variables, you get this symmetric hyperbolic system for the scalar field and its derivatives. And it turns out that the scalar field itself doesn't appear in either of these equations. So we're not even going to bother evolving this one. We're just going to evolve the four variables down here. And of course, you see this is true for whatever arbitrary fixed background metric that you want to use. So let me go to, see, where do I want to go to? So I can do that. Okay. So the first thing that I want to show you is I'm going to evolve phi x right there. Okay, that actually doesn't look as good at this resolution as it did before. Let me tell you a little bit about the grid. This is very much related to an earlier talk that I gave. This particular grid, this is a 3D code, and let me draw this in 2D since we have a 2D blackboard. The grid is made up of multiple domains that have basically this shape. This is a square that's just deformed into this sort of shape. And then you put, in 2D, you put four of these together, like so. In 3D, there's six of them. And what you see up here, you see the initial data for the variable, the x derivative of the scalar field, where x, again, is the x component of this little r. And these white lines are the domain boundaries. The outer boundary on this one is at, see, it's at r equals 1.8, which corresponds to something around 10m in there's no m here. This is a flat space. It corresponds to about 10. In Minkowski r. So let me evolve this. And so you see this wave start oscillating and go out perfectly fine. And one thing that I'd like to, I can go back and then repeat it. One thing I'd like to point out is that we don't see any evidence of any sort of current difficulty, which is something that you might have anticipated, and that's because of this compactification that we do. Let me go backwards again.
Is the outer boundary condition that you set the scalar field to zero in the outer boundary?
So I'll get to, no, it's not, and I'll get to the outer boundary condition in a second. I'll get to it when I get to Schwarzschild, but I have a slide about that because it turns out that the outer boundary condition does turn out to be important. So right here, what the outer boundary condition is all the incoming characteristic fields are set to constant in time. So their time derivatives are set to zero. Okay. So let's see. Let me show you, so this is flat space again. So I'm going to show you on exactly the same scale the the same run that I just showed, minus the analytic solution, since we do have an analytic solution in this case. And this isn't that, come on. The play button doesn't work well. If the whole movie goes by in about a millisecond if I hit the play button. There we go. And you see, if you look at the same scale as before, this guy is several orders of magnitude down from the.
The error, what is the
error there? So the error there is during the, it's something like right now you can see that it's at 0.1 at late times in the, and it was of order, the wave was of order 10.
Is it dominated by truncation error or by outer boundary error?
It's dominated by truncation error at about right here, and you notice that it's at about 0.01. And then at late times, it starts becoming dominated by outer boundary error. And you see that the error actually is going up, and that has and that's sort of a precursor to an instability that starts developing at very late times. Okay. So. Let me show you another one, and this is more a show you that we can do it plot. So here I don't actually show the grid lines, but this is actually a different grid configuration. And so the grid configuration here is we have a spherical shell. And that overlaps a cube. So the center of the interior of this spherical annulus is excised. But since this is Minkowski space, you actually can't excise without a boundary condition. So we fill it in by putting a cube around it. And the reason I'm showing you this is because the Schwarzschild case we're going to be doing in annuli instead of these types of shapes, because we don't quite have this working in the with complicated boundary conditions. And I'll get into boundary conditions in a second. So again, this is the same solution as before. And you see, and here it's actually dominated by truncation error rather than outer boundary error, because I fixed the outer boundary condition in this one. So right now you can see that the error is 0.003 or something. You still see a little bit of small ripples.
What evolution scheme are you using for this?
So this again is a scalar wave on flat space. So this is a spectral evolution scheme. So it's our basis functions are Chebyshev's in radius on the sphere, and YLM's an angle, and then in the cube they're Chebyshev polynomials in all three directions. And the time iteration is fourth order Runge-Kutta. I can close some of these.
Is there a CFL condition really for this kind of?
Yes, there is.
How do you determine what it is?
So how should you determine it, or how do we determine it? There's two questions. So in theory, you have to look at the eigenvalues of the matrix and so on, but we don't bother doing that. What we actually do is you look at the same way in finite differencing. You look at the distance between the closest collocation points, because we're using pseudospectral, so we actually have collocation points. And that gives you, roughly the same Courant condition as you would if you did it the right way. So
I'm not sure what you mean by the right way, but like you said, first is
the right,
looking for an instability, not
the domain. Yes, exactly. The right way is actually computing the eigenvalues of the derivative matrix that you're using, and that, those will depend on, well, actually, the whole update operator, and those will depend on delta T in such, in a certain way. Exactly, exactly. But you actually get about the same answer if you just take a look at the delta X between your two closest collocation points and say delta T is less than that, if C is 1.
Of course, parameter by looking at instabilities evidenced in the eigenvalues of a matrix. The interpretation of that result then is in terms of completely domain dependent.
Kill this. So now let me show you a Schwarzschild run. And let me.
I'd like to ask another question about collected space.
Yes?
Is this illusion stable or not?
So it depends on which case you're talking about. Okay. So currently the evolution looks like it's unstable in this case. But in this case, which I'm going to talk about a little bit earlier, we don't have the code set up to handle more complicated outer boundary conditions. In this case, it looks like flat space is stable. The wave equation in flat space is stable. So let me show you Schwarzschild. So now we tried to do Schwarzschild in this same domain, except now get rid of the cube and make sure that this inner boundary is inside the horizon. And if you, once you do that, then excision in this type of spectral method means you just don't impose any boundary condition at all. And let me show you what first happened when we tried this. So we have a wave propagating. Oops. And then the whole thing starts blowing up. And so now the game is to try to figure out why the heck it's doing this. So the first thing that we tried, of course, is fiddling around with the time step. Turns out it made no difference at all. This was not a Courant problem. Then we started getting the idea that what happens in pseudospectral evolution methods a lot is that if you have a sharp feature that's appearing in your solution, rather than just losing the resolution near that sharp feature, what happens with a spectral code is it in general it does exactly this. So even though if you were talking about finite differencing and somebody said, oh, use a higher resolution and it might be stable, I would say you're nuts. With pseudospectral methods, often you can get instabilities that are actually caused by using too low of resolution. So now let me show 11E. Show you one. So now this is exactly the same thing at a higher resolution, and it actually runs for much longer. And at late times, you do see a little bit of spikiness, and I think that it's probably going to eventually blow up. But it ran twice as long as the other one, and with the errors are now the size of this thing is now down at 0.05 when this thing is at over 1 or 1.
You said the place where you had the negative eigen speed going up.
Yes, and we think that's what it's caused by, and the spikiness is actually everywhere because this is a pseudospectral code. So once you have one place in your grid where you don't have enough resolution, you see it everywhere.
Well, so, yeah, it looks like it's a lot worse in that little ridge in the middle.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So this is where the sharpness is.
It's a graphics representation of the solutions are actually smoother.
Yeah. Yeah, so this graphics representation, what's done is a slice is cut through this sphere, and then it's interpolated onto a 200 by 200 rectangular grid for making this movie. And so some of what you're seeing is the grid.
Usually in a finite difference code, you can recognize where the instability is, instability of the interior, like if it dissipate away, or a boundary layer instability, that you have to use boundary methods.
Yeah.
I don't know how it works.
Sometimes you can, because it usually starts off at a certain place, but very quickly, once you have an instability, it spreads.
The question is being generated at the boundary, or is it?
So I.
Or is it being generated in the interior?
Right, and I think there's actually two effects. I think there's actually two effects. I think that there's one problem that's being generated at all of these sharp peaks that you get, basically because the speed of light, it's just outside the horizon, because the speed of light goes down and then comes and comes back up, the ingoing speed of light. So you get this piling up effect. And I think that there's also some problem with the boundary. So let me talk a little bit about the boundary.
These two are interacting with each other, I guess, over a number of crossing times, feeding on each other.
Mm-hmm. But as far as we can tell, the more resolution I throw at this, the better it gets. So far it seems to be just a lack of resolution problem rather than a numerical instability. Crossing times is sort of difficult because these are hyperboloidal slices. So this is at time t equals 30 or u equals 30. So
the width of the pulse
is 0.4. Or in this case, the width was 0.2. In this case, the width was 0.2.
Basically, if you say the light goes out very quick, how fast is it?
Yeah. What you're seeing here is the quasi-normal ringing of the black hole, right? So the initial pulse is out long ago. That's out by in these units something like t equals 8 or something like that. But then you see all this quasi-normal ringing in here.
So you're evolving the background space.
You still see quasi-normal ringing if you have a linearized field in a black hole space-time. It's the same effect.
So the energy goes in there and it gets caught around the two pulsing potentials and sits there for a while before it goes back out again or down the hole.
Yeah.
What I'm not seeing is, what do you see here that you don't see
in, say,
the standard slices?
Well, part of what I'm trying to show is that when you do this, things don't immediately go bad, right? Because one possibility is, oh, you try this on hyperboloidal slices and the whole thing is a disaster, even in flat space. Right, and it turns out that there are some tricky points. One of them is this sharpening of the quasi-normal ringing as it goes inward, and another one is the boundary, which I'm going to tell you about.
But the sharpening you would get in the Kármán-Kósy code is just that you would have to go to late times.
The sharpening is because the speed of light is doing this. Right, so if you had the speed of light being monotonic, then I don't think you'd get this.
So that's no worse than the usual.
Yeah, at this point it's no worse. And so then the question is going to be, is it better? And we haven't gotten there yet.
Okay. But where's your boundary?
So here the boundary here is at 1.9 little r, which is equivalent to about 80 m in Schwarzschild radius. So this boundary is out pretty far. And the inner boundary is inside the horizon.
The initial waves were
gone a long, long time ago. So.
Take a long time to see.
I see the virtue of the overall idea, but I was looking for the text. So you're focusing on just saying that it's not
powerful too.
Yeah, so the big question is going to be, which we haven't answered yet, is how far out can we push this outer boundary before things start going bad?
And can you run long enough that the original outgoing pulse went out?
Yeah, and that we can do, and that I've just shown we can do. And if there was no such thing as quasi-normal ringing, this would be all gone. And one thing that you don't notice is you don't see the outgoing pulse very much on this plot. And the reason is because once the outgoing pulse gets anywhere past around here, it gets spread out so much because you're on a null slice that you just don't even see it on this plot.
And then it's gone in about T2 or 3.
Yeah.
Why were you able to put the actual outer boundary at scry in the flat case and you can only go out?
Oh, I didn't put it at scry in the flat case either. No. I didn't put it at scry in the flat case either. And the reason that I can't in either case is because both the lapse and the shift blow up at scry.
Well, in your equation, there's a singular variable. You don't extract the singular part of it, then you're in trouble.
Right.
So that's why I'm saying phase two would be to extract the singular part, and then one should be able to keep things even more.
Right. But we haven't done that yet.
Where did you put in the flat case? I thought you had R equal 2F in that.
No, the only one that was in R equal 2 was when Charlie put down the analytic solution.
Oh, that was all analytic.
That was analytic.
It was just a very simple formula plotted.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah, that analytic solution was what before when I showed that error plot where you saw basically nothing happening. That was comparing the numerical evolution versus the thing that Charlie showed you. So that was
That only went out to 1.8 or so.
Yeah, the numerical one only went out to 1.8. And it turns out that as you go out farther, things get worse, and we don't yet understand why.
We suspect. Once the cube goes to infinity, and it's still been left in the equation.
Right. So let me talk a little bit about boundaries, since that has been.
Using these boundaries with a large shift is troublesome. I know we're not going to finite difference goals.
Yeah, so I think that's another problem is that we have a large shift. Where do I want to be? I want to be there. So let's go to the. So, the boundary condition that I've been showing you in some of these runs, but not all. Is that the ingoing characteristic field has its time derivative, its u derivative set to zero. So if you work out for the variables that I showed you before, what are the characteristic fields in some given direction? This is what you get. You get an outgoing and an ingoing that have a speed that has a shift piece and a light cone piece. And then you have a zero speed mode, is what we call it, but it's actually speed that goes like minus a shift.
So the top formula should be CI dotted into that formula?
It depends on what you wanted to, how you want to normalize things, yeah. But it could be C lower I dotted into that would be, give you a scalar speed, and CI dotted into that one will give you a scalar speed.
But the field itself, the scalar field, is supposed to vanish at scry. So how do the equations know that the boundary condition is supposed to translate?
Well, let me tell you. So I'm going to tell you this boundary condition. That's why I called it a naive boundary condition, because it actually generates reflections and ingoing pulses at the outer boundary. It has to. But you can actually work out a better boundary condition. So the better boundary condition, which comes from assuming that your scalar field is some outgoing pulse, goes like u minus r star over r, where r star is sort of like the usual r star that you define in Schwarzschild coordinates, but on this particular slice. So r star actually goes to this r star goes to zero at scry. So then you have something that's just f of u over r. If you assume
the definition is that u minus r star should be an equal constant, should be a radial null, right?
So if you assume this, then, and you work out what the boundary condition should be, you get something like this, where you have the time derivative of your incoming characteristic field depends on your variables plus all kinds of other stuff that has to do with what your background metric is.
Okay, is this a legal boundary condition from the symmetric hyperbolic?
Absolutely. The incoming characteristic field equals anything is a legal boundary condition. As long as you don't touch the outgoing characteristic field, you can do anything else that you want.
But you're coupling it. It's coupled to the outgoing field.
So yeah. But so there's a time derivative here. Notice there's a time derivative here, and there's not a time derivative there. Yes, this assumes a spherically symmetric wave when you do this. So it's not going to be exact. No, this is the equivalent of a Sommerfeld condition, right? If you did this in flat space, in
the data that you use for this 3D run wasn't spherically symmetric.
So the scalar field was spherically symmetric, but the variables that I'm actually using are not. So this should generate the right thing. And
those other curves you showed, or the visualizations you showed, were all for spherically symmetric.
They were for spherically symmetric. Scalar field, which gives you non-spherically symmetric, say x derivative, of course, was not going to be. And so the hope is, and we've seen this in other cases, that if you do something like this, which is good for the spherical case, that once you have a non-spherical case, the differences are smaller by some higher power of 1 over r.
I assume after in the 1 over r term,
That's okay, but that's okay because this is these are angular dependent too.
Changes in theta sweep you over such large distances.
Yeah.
You know, all they have to do is apply that boundary condition at each angle.
Yeah. This boundary condition is imposed at each. Yeah. So there's angular dependence in this one too.
But unless you know the quadrupole dependence of the field, you know the multiple dependence.
Yeah. Oh, it's not going to be exact. I'm not saying this is going to be exact. Yeah, I'm not saying it's going to be exact. I'm saying it's going to be. I'm saying that I'm hoping it's going to be good to leading order. That's.
But this right, that's explain, all so this might minimize or not the reflections or the non-transparent boundary condition. But that doesn't explain why you got an instability.
Well, it might. And so let me show you two snapshots. Let me show you two snapshots.
You have a problem that is quasi-linear. The coefficients only depends on time and the space. So your theorems tell you they shouldn't have it.
But resolution is getting very bad.
Yeah.
So very bad. So
here's a
waves out there.
But
higher resolution,
you shouldn't see
it.
Yes.
By
condition
of
visibility,
it shouldn't get worse.
That's right.
So here, let me show you. This is a snapshot from an evolution that I didn't show you. This is one that before I fixed the boundary condition, and what happens is that when you get a reflection at the outer boundary, this reflection is incredibly sharp as it propagates in. And again, because of this sharpness that you have, the spectral method has problems with it. And so what I'm showing you here is just some snapshot. This is at t equals 15, which in these units is well after the initial wave has gone out, and there's a wave that's starting to propagate in, and you can see it here. And the next frame is exactly the same solution at exactly the same time with the different boundary condition. And now you see nothing going on up here, and you still see the quasi-normal ringing in there. Yeah, the lower resolution gets worse quicker.
Okay.
In basically every case in every case that I've run so far. But the other thing that you notice in this one, it's not only the big thing at the boundary that's different, but you also see a whole bunch of wiggles right around here in the interior that seem to be, these are sort of these pseudospectral wiggles that you get once you're trying to resolve this really sharp thing. You get wiggles everywhere. And then going to the other boundary condition really kills those things too. So that. Okay. Fill the box. Let's see, what else do I have here? So another thing that we found is that even with the good boundary condition, it still requires a lot of resolution to evolve these things because of the sharpening in the middle. And even more strange, if you move your outer boundary out farther, say from 1.8 to 1.9, which is the equivalent of Schwarzschild radius of 40 to 80, basically, that things get much more difficult. So let me show you another case where I've moved the boundary in a bit. Let's see, this is this one here. So now I've moved the boundary in a bit, and even at late times, up to t equals 30, you don't see any more of these wiggles, and we don't understand that.
No big problem, no big lapse coming in, but you say you don't understand.
We don't understand. I mean, the lapse is smaller. At the outer boundary, so the lapse, but that's just a factor of 1/q, and that's, you know, in this case it's about 10, and that's not that big, so I don't quite understand why it makes such a huge difference.
So the shift is getting larger as you move.
And the shift is shift too, yeah. By
surprising that you're closing down the
and the shift as well by, you know.
What
factor
did the shift change?
The shift, I believe, I think the shift goes like 1/q as well. So it's really not that much. It's like a factor of, it's actually a factor of 2, isn't it? Yeah, because everything goes like 1. Yeah. Yeah. It's actually just a factor of 2. So one thing that's kind of neat is if I repeat this evolution, but now what I'm going to do, it should be coming up. I thought I did. Okay, so I'm going to repeat this evolution, but what I'm going to do now is each frame is going to be scaled so that the maximum value is going to be, say, about here on this plot. And what you can see here is the quasi-normal ringing of the hole. And it just sits there and rings. And you see a little bit of high-frequency stuff at late times. But the amplitude is going down exponentially here. And at the outer boundary at 1.8, you can do this and everything still remains smooth. But if I do this same thing at 1.9, see if I can find that one. Okay, so I'm going to do this. So I'm now going to put the outer boundary at 1.9, and I'm going to repeat the same thing, and I'm even going to use a bit higher resolution. I needed to. And when everything scales, you still see the quasi-normal ringing, but at late times, you start getting spikiness. Let me go back. And then it seems clear that things are blowing up at late times there. But I've run exactly this to exactly the same time as before.
The picture stops changing at the end, but the actual scale is going down.
It's well, it's a self-similar blow up, it looks like, yeah.
How many harmonics are you using?
So this one, a lot. So 81 in the radial direction, which is enormous for spectral. Usually, you know, our highest resolution is like 30 or something like that. And so the reason that we have to do this, I believe, if I go back here, you can see, one reason is you can see how sharp these little waves are becoming. And eventually they become sharp enough that everything starts going to heck. Even in this case, you see them going very sharp too. But what I don't understand is what the is why the outer boundary makes such a difference there.
In that paper we put out a couple of months ago, they will analyze basically the same kind of system. Mm-hmm. We saw there if you define pi to be just a time derivative of pi,
mm-hmm.
There you had a system that was symmetric and hyperbolic everywhere but inside a black hole where it was strong hyperbolic.
Mm-hmm.
But at the outer boundary, you could provide boundary conditions that actually didn't let everything go out of the grid.
Mm-hmm.
If you use the one you are using, then there, in order to use maximum spectral boundary condition in the way we do it, you have to have reflections. If wave couldn't go cleanly out of the grid, so some part of the wave had to be reflected up. So the cure to that was the hybrid of the two,
mm-hmm.
which is
right.
Basically interpolation between the two. And so at the outer boundary, you can let everything go cleanly out. And as you go inside the black hole,
right.
Then you have this still
right.
Remain.
Right. So my cure was to kill the mass, a maximally dissipative condition and actually put something going in.
Right.
Yeah.
You might want to try
mm-hmm.
the alpha region, which is very simple. It's just an interpolation. So basically, you change the shift.
Right.
You go up.
Right. But as you see, this is very much work in progress, and it's only been going on for the last week or two, and we can safely say that there's no disastrous problems as of yet for using these hyperboloidal slices. But as you also notice, there's a lot of questions that we haven't yet been able to answer, such as what's really the cause of all these instabilities that we're seeing? Is it just this sharpening here? Is it something having to do with the outer boundary? Is it a combination of both, or is it something completely different? The evidence that we have so far is that every time I throw more resolution at it, it gets better. Another piece of evidence, by the way, is I repeated one of these runs. I think it was this one with a time step a half of what cut down by a factor of two, and the two evolutions were the same to something like 1 part in 10 to the 8. So it doesn't seem to have anything to do with time stepping problems.
Unless you're more than factor two, might be interesting to go down in factor 10 or so.
Okay, we could try it a factor of 10 as well. But even a factor of two, you would think that you would get something different if there was a.
Well, it depends how much you have by your waving.
Yeah. But typically if you're violating, what happens is the bigger your time step, the worse your violation is, and the quicker everything blows up. And we weren't seeing that at all. Everything was acting exactly the same at exactly the same time. But we can try other cutting it down by and waiting longer.
In the past, there were cases where you had different behavior. Well, that you needed to ADS a little bit. Are you ADS something here?
Or? Yes. Yeah. So here we're filtering in the spherical direction.
That's because
it's one of these. Yeah. That's because it's one of these. And the reason that I haven't done Schwarzschild in these as much is well, number one, this is sort of more mature and we understand this a little bit better. And this is, you know, sort of the new thing that we've been moving towards. The other thing is that we have a lot of capabilities in this case to monkey around with boundary conditions and so on, to, you know, change them very easily. In this case, that's not quite built in yet. I showed you some examples with this and no aliasing in that case yet. But I fully expect that in this case, once we're nonlinear, we might need to do aliasing. And still, even in the linear case, there are cases here where we do get instabilities that we don't understand, and we're going to try using aliasing to cure those. But part of the problem is that it's not clear whether the instabilities that you see in a spectral code are just due to lack of resolution, or if they're actually real, you know, honest-to-God instabilities. So the other thing that we hope to answer that we haven't answered yet is the question of how far out can you go? How far out can you push your outer boundary? Because, you know, after all, what we'd really like to do is put it to scry. We know we can't do that because things blow up unless we do this sort of phase two and factor out something. But one of the things that would be kind of neat to see is if using one of these slices, you can say put your outer boundary at, you know, say 1,000 m or 2,000 m, using the same amount of grid as you usually use, you know, to put your outer boundary out at 10 m. We haven't been able to demonstrate anything like that yet. And in fact, we seem to be having problems when we start putting our outer boundary out farther, and we still don't understand where those are coming from.
I wonder how much this scale away the question, not informally regular. You know, for example, we're talking the other day, Maxwell's equations wouldn't have this problem with a large lattice and shift, so you could probably put the outer boundary in scry.
Mm-hmm.
But whether that's relevant or not depends on what the long-range aim is. I mean, if you want to code up Lyle-Pinzer propagation equations, those are also conformally regular, as Sasha knows very well. So, I mean, but
right.
Do you even believe that Maxwell would have run out to spry if he loaded that up, or is that just a conjecture? I mean, what do you
It wouldn't. So we're not really sure what's causing this problem at the outer boundary. We don't know if it's because of the lapse and shift blowing up, which are, it's an obvious candidate for it. But what seems to argue against that is that we've only put the outer boundary out to 1.9, which in these units is about 80 m or so, and we're still having a lot of problems.
What's the problem with the
What
are the values of the Johnson?
The lapse of the shift, they go linearly, so they're you know, of order 80. That's pretty big, but it's not like they're 10 to the 6, right?
One, if you were doing Maxwell's equation,
yeah.
Even if you put them all the way to scry, because
right.
The bigness cancels out.
Right, but for instance, we see a lot more problems when we go from 40 to 80, right? And okay, so there we have a factor of 2 in lapse and shift, and you know, and the problems that we have, that we're seeing seem to be more than factor of two problems, right? But again, this is very preliminary, and we've just been running this sort of thing for you know, in fact, I've only been running Schwarzschild for, I guess, since Friday. So you know, there's a lot that can be done and should be done. And also, you know, this you know, there's some of these things like the sharpening and so on that can probably be looked at analytically and looked at with a 1D code.
So let me see if I can understand you right. You are uncertain at this stage where your instability is coming from, whether it's coming from the outer boundary or it's coming from what you call black hole ringing, which I don't think is a black hole ringing, because that's just backscattering of the color field of the black
Yeah, but that's the same thing as black hole ringing.
The black hole is not really ringing.
No, no, the black hole isn't doing anything, but it's still a...
Yeah, it's a really tight equation.
It's the same equation. If you linearize the gravitational field, right? If you linearize the gravitational field and then you solve the equations for black hole ringing, you get an equation that looks just like a scalar wave equation on the background. So it's essentially the same thing with a different spin of the field.
The scalar wave is ringing.
The scalar wave is ringing in the black hole background.
You
know, yeah.
So you have the two effects. You have the backscatter and the ringing. Here you just have the backscattering. But anyway, this is another.
Black hole doesn't ring.
That's right.
Ringing is not.
No, the backscatter and the ringing are separate because you always get the backscatter and you only get the ringing if there's a black hole.
That's right.
Yeah, you get rid of the ringing if you put the inner boundary at R equals 10 out. So, right? Not the same thing. Then you have two boundaries and you just see if the ringing is there.
Yeah. I could get rid of that. Yeah, but yeah, it's not.
But my question is the following: if you change the solution, you probably have a different decay time of this of the backscattering. Have you checked?
No. The K time is the same. You mean the K time of this thing?
Yeah.
Yeah, as independent of resolution.
No, but you're surely going to have a different behavior.
This is essentially an analytic solution, right? You can solve for the ringing, and you can solve, well, not analytic, but you know, ODE solution, you know, Zirilli or you know, whatever you want for a scalar field, and you can show that you get ringing like this, right? I mean, so this thing here is not a numerical artifact.
No, I'm not saying it's a numerical artifact. I'm saying the decay time. If you look at the known versus time. Of the way those waves are decaying in time, you surely have a dependence. I mean, analytically, if you are in a convergent ring, then fine. But if you change your resolution, then you're probably going to see a different slope.
He's claiming the one resolved.
Yeah, I'm claiming this is well resolved. At least at this case, the ones where you see the spikiness, it's not. I mean, so one thing about these spectral methods is that when you're not well resolved, you generally blow up, but once you are well resolved, you're usually damn well resolved because everything converges exponentially. Sure.
No, because you say.
Okay, I have a fourth order time stepper. Yeah. Okay. Okay, I have a fourth order time stepper. So, but it's actually better than fourth order because the delta t goes down faster than linearly. But okay. Fine. Yeah. It's close enough to exponential.
So one of these Mexico tests is actually the evolved the hyperboloids in cosmic space with a standard Kuznetsov core.
Mm-hmm.
And that's so the only one I think that is actually done in this area extended.
Okay.
And he didn't have much fun. He didn't try to push the boundaries further and further outside.
Okay.
I don't remember how far he put them outside, but not very far.
Okay.
So he didn't really get into that core. But so the basic kind of thing. And I'm not sure what other boundary conditions we use, but something like some of them.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe the same, maybe
something similar. Yeah, well, the thing that I showed you on is basically Sommerfeld. I mean, it reduces the Sommerfeld if you're on a Minkowski slice rather than a hyperboloidal slice, and it's derived the same way. You assume, you know, f of t minus r over r, and you know, compute some boundary condition with that. Okay, well, that's all I have.